What's up, Beardos? You're listening to episode 201 of The Bearded Vegans.
Basically, our whole philosophy boils down to don't be a jerk.
Don't answer the question first try. Not answering the question. I really hope people didn't tune in to hear us talk about beards.
Welcome to the show. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com, and you can always reach us by emailing thebeardvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we're going to answer some listener emails before turning the microphone over to our wonderful audience.
That's right, Paul. We are coming to you live from the Halifax Veg Fest. Woo! Give yourselves a hand.
Yes, thank you all for being here. This is my first time in Halifax. I love it, although I've only been here for less than 24 hours, and I'm leaving in about 4 hours. So I will have to come back at some point, because it's been cool so far, and I would like to spend more time here.
Yeah, we got a nice meal in at En V last night, but otherwise just mostly enjoying all the delicious food that's been here right now.
And meeting all the wonderful people, too.
Yeah, y'all are pretty awesome. Everyone, I mean, it's the Canadian stereotype, but everyone is super nice and very friendly. So thank you all for coming out and making us feel comfortable. So these things are, like, weird, because normally we just have conversations talking to ourselves. Now we have to do it, like, facing forward at a bunch of people. We know a lot of people have come up and said hi, and they love the podcast. But for anyone that's not familiar, you know, we're not people that are here to tell you what to do or how to think or how to live your life. But we are two people that like to think about some of the more ethical gray areas and the moral conundrums that come up while you're living a vegan life. And so, you know, we're not here to give a specific answer to things, but we find that by having the conversations ourselves, we help ourselves figure out how we feel, and other people occasionally find benefit of that as well. So,
and we like to talk about questions that don't have a clear black or white yes, no answer too.
Yes, for sure. So with the live podcast, we really like to interact with everybody. We like to get questions, have conversations in that regard. I know it's always scary to be like the first question that gets asked. So we've brought in a couple of listener emails that we're going to respond to. And then after two or three of those, we're going to open it up to everyone. So start thinking of your questions now.
Shall we get to the first question?
Let's get to that first question.
All right, this is an email from Jim C., who asks, I've been vegan for 3 years and been going really hard on activism for the last 2 years. Lately, however, I've been starting to feel really burnt out. Whenever I try to take breaks, though, I end up feeling selfish because all I can think about is how the animals never get to take a break and they need our voices constantly. Do you have any tips on preventing burnout that doesn't involve taking time out of activism?
So, first off, I'll say I can certainly relate to this question a lot. I think that there's a huge rhetoric in this movement that is essentially just that thought that Jim put out, which is animals have it so much worse than we do, and it's a disservice to them to take time off for ourselves, and that we always have to be working. So I want to address that, and I want to address the specific question of, like, what can I do to continue being an activist while still sort of keeping that focus on the animals? That's what we put up as our title. So rarely do we actually respond to our title, but this is actually happening now. So I guess the first thing I want to say is I think it's important for us to redefine activism to include taking care of ourselves. That it doesn't, you don't always have to think of activism as being strictly the going out to the protest, handing out the leaflets, doing whatever it is that you do. And we've had a lot of conversations on the show, Paul, about, like, what does activism actually mean? Does it mean boots on the ground? Does it mean baking vegan cupcakes and handing them out to people? Does it mean just having a strong presence online? Like, whatever it is. So I think it's important for us to redefine activism that both includes activism that makes us feel fulfilled and sustained, something that we can do repeatedly without feeling incredibly burnt out, which is not to say, I don't think activism necessarily needs to make you feel good, because I think we often fall into this trap of doing activism that makes us feel good that is not necessarily helpful. Things like yelling at people and getting that aggression out, which can be cathartic, but maybe not necessarily the most effective thing to do. So redefining activism to mean things that have you practicing your ethic, practicing veganism in your life, and hopefully having conversations with others, but not necessarily something where it feels like it has to be super draining. You know, so I think it's like people finding things that they feel good about doing and finding things that use their skills. So, for instance, someone might be a great writer, and they shouldn't feel like any less of an activist if they are only writing about issues, or only podcasting about issues, or only baking, or whatever it is, because we can't all do everything at the same time. And then when I talk about, I'll let you say something a second, Paul. When I think about redefining our activism, I think about making it include that time off, making it include that self-care, making it include doing work on community care as well. And that if we aren't thinking about, I'm going to the movies tonight and that's a part of my activism, because a part of my activism is ensuring that I'll be doing this 10, 20, 30 years from now, not just 2 years from now. Because I see this email and I see 2 years and I say, that's about right. I see so many people come into this movement and they go super hard for 2 years and then they get so burnt out on it and they turn to their friends and fellow activists who say, you're not doing enough, you're not going hard enough. And then they just exit the scene entirely as opposed to sticking around. So that's like my response to Jim, which is basically like activism can include taking time off. Like think about it as a marathon as opposed to a sprint.
Although in a marathon, you're also running the whole time as well.
Yeah, but you're not going as fast as you possibly can, as hard as you can. Like I get that we all want to sprint through the marathon because there's never enough time to do all of the things that we need to work on.
All right. I'll allow that metaphor. I think also, you know, you're talking about redefining activism. I think, you know, we also need to redefine it for ourselves. And this is all stuff that you gave all the great points. So I guess I'll just reinforce them. But redefining it for yourself, because I think we all have these, like, we all have special skills that's going to allow us to do something that another vegan activist might not be able to do. And I think especially when, like, social media, I think there's certain types, specific types of activism that get a lot more views than other types. And therefore, I think there are then people who say, like, oh, okay, well, this is the activism that's getting tons and tons of views, so this must be the thing that I have to do to be a good advocate. But I think that realizing you don't need to do any one specific thing, and in fact, you probably don't want to do the thing that's going to put you so far out of your comfort zone that it's just not going to be sustainable, right? Like, yeah. You want to do the thing that you're going to be able to keep doing, and I think only you know what that thing is going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do think there's a lot to be said for pushing yourself a little bit outside of your comfort zone, though.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not someone that necessarily loves going out and having a million conversations with strangers, but I have, like, pushed myself to do that. And I guess actually this proves your point, because I did that for about 2 years and then I felt so burnt out on it. But I gained a lot of from that experience. I, like, learned a lot about how to talk to people and, like, ways to find quiet time to myself to recharge in between doing, you know, 8 hours of conversations, you know, 5 days a week.
Yeah, no, certainly there's benefit from putting yourself into an uncomfortable position, which I think for most people is how we learn and grow. And if you think about it, with many types of activism, that's what we're trying to put on non-vegans as well, right? We're trying to put them in this place that's going to be uncomfortable for them because it's challenging their, you know, challenging someone's whole lifestyle or their views for their entire life up until that point. So it's like we're asking them to be put into a slightly uncomfortable position, but maybe, I don't know, maybe we can take out of this. It's like, okay, I know I don't want to be put in an extremely uncomfortable position, so maybe I shouldn't put other people in an extremely uncomfortable position. But you are right that there's going to be some element of uncomfortableness.
Yeah, and that's something that I wrestle with. This is like leading into a whole different conversation, though, but of like how much uncomfortability, like comfort do we owe to people that are engaging in unethical acts in how we talk to them and confront them about those things?
Well, I think then that goes into, like, what do they deserve? Like, is it not that bad that we're putting them in this uncomfortable position because they are doing these bad things? But at the same time, if we know that that's not going to be effective, then it's like, wouldn't we want to find some balance between those two things?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Should we get back onto the topic of the question?
We should. So I guess I mentioned community care, Paul, and we did a extensive 1 or 2 part self-care episode before. And one of the responses we got from a listener was essentially like, self-care is all well and good, but what about community care? Because self-care is kind of like individualizing the issue. And really the issue is this whole collective system that we're in. And so I think to answer, to frame it in the way that Jim is talking about, I think that one could consider a part of their activism working towards having conversations with fellow activists towards a culture of community care, which means not creating a culture of the animals have it so much worse, you have to be going all the time, because that extends to so many things and excuses so many horrible situations that happen, like even at like nonprofits, you know, where it's like you have to work hard, you have to get paid very little because it's for the animals, because it's for an altruistic reason, which is like what muddies the whole waters, because there's something that we all drastically believe in, we know we need to be working on all the time. But if you make it a part of your activism to create that culture where it's okay for your friends and activists to take that time off or to engage in like more pleasurable activism, and maybe that is baking or cooking for somebody or just making a web comic or, you know, whatever it might be, creating a culture that values those things could also, you could consider that a part of your activism as well.
Yeah, and I think that community care and just finding your community, because if you are someone that's feeling burnt out and doesn't have the community, I think that finding that community could do wonders for helping that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
Move on to this next question.
Let's move on. All right. So we got this email from Shelley from England, and Shelley wrote us this really lengthy email, and we're going to kind of summarize it as best we can, read a little bit from it. But essentially, the email was about sustainable clothing and talked about this brand in England that uses leftover scraps, and that includes wool. That includes wool. And so kind of like asking, like, how do you feel about this? Like, is it ethical? Because it would have gone to a landfill potentially. And then we'll talk about that a little bit. But the thing I really want to zero in is the second half of this email. And so Shelley writes, there is an animal sanctuary brand in England which makes coats from the wool of the sheep rescued from slaughter. I am definitely supportive of this MO. The only reason I don't buy is because of the dyes used. A lot of vegans will say sheep don't need to be shorn, but that only applies to wild sheep and not most domesticated breeds. If done based on slow fashion business model, therefore eliminating the harm that can be done by shearing, I don't see the issue with this and wonder why more sanctuaries don't take this up. So Paul, this is almost like a version of the why can't we eat eggs, or why should we choose not to eat eggs from the chickens that are rescued at a sanctuary. So what say you?
So I think that like the eggs from chickens from a sanctuary, this question kind of falls into the category of like this thing is a byproduct that's not necessarily harming this specific animal, so why don't we use it? And I think more broadly it falls into this discussion of like do we have the right to use something from that was created by someone else just because they're not necessarily using it? And I think me personally, I would push against that sort of philosophy. And I think the reason I'm pushing against it is because I think it's formed from the fact that we have learned that animals from childhood, that animals are ours to use and their byproducts and their bodies are ours to use. And I think even as we kind of transition to try and have a more compassionate ethic, I still think we have some crossover with that kind of philosophy that we've been beaten over the head with ever since we've been little. And I think it's most obvious in the fact that we wouldn't use that, we wouldn't apply that philosophy to like to other humans, or we wouldn't even apply that philosophy to other animals, you know?
Can you think of a human, like an equal situation for something like human labor that has created something that people would then take because the human's not going to use it though?
Well, I think this specific situation would be like if every time, I guess if I got a haircut and then they just used my hair for something without asking me, I guess.
Do you have a problem with that? Would you be like, how dare you use my hair?
I guess I don't have as much of a problem with that. Because, okay, so you're kind of catching me. Because what I was going to say, Andy, is because the other piece of this philosophy is the fact that a lot of people are like, oh, well, it's wasting this if we don't use it.
Yeah.
But that certainly, that doesn't apply to like human hair. We would never say like, oh, you got to collect all this human hair because it's going to be wasted. Or even with animals, you know, it's like when we groom, if you are like taking care of a cat or a dog and you groom them and you're trimming them and stuff, no one's like, hey, you're not going to use, you using that cat hair over there? So it's like, I feel like it only applies to animals that we're used to using their bodies and their byproducts for. And we don't apply it to other things. It's never seen as wasting you know, wasting hair or wasting other parts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, Paul?
Yeah?
Touche. I think that's actually, like, a really good point, because you wouldn't make that analogy to even, like, dog hair waste or something like that. I think that it's really important. I mean, there's a few things that do make me kind of waver on this and wonder about it, but the main thing that I would push back on with the email is essentially the idea that something is considered waste if it is not utilized by human beings. And I did actually reach out to a number of sanctuary friends, organizers, runners, volunteers, and asked people, what do you do with that wool, like, when you shear it? Not because I think it needs to go and do something, but I am really curious, because I think a lot of people are surprised to learn that almost every sanctuary I've ever visited, the eggs that the chickens lay, they feed them back to the chickens, because those chickens are coming from a system where, you know, the selective breeding, they're laying way more eggs than they would if they sort of just existed naturally out in the world, and they are depleted of all the calcium and other nutrients, and so by eating the eggs, they gain a lot of those things back. And I was surprised to learn that. I think a lot of people are surprised to learn that fact. And so I do think it's like, oh, is there actually a use for this wool that could still benefit the specific animal that it came from? And a lot of sanctuary owners basically said they just take the wool and, like, put it out in the woods, and birds use it, other animals, like wild animals, use it for nesting. And some just said they put it in the compost pile because it does actually compost. And so, I don't know, I guess I would wonder if someone would say, well, that's, like, a waste, because that's not helping, like, humans out instead. But I guess I think it's important to notice that there is, like, a utilization of it. But even if there wasn't, I'm not sure if I would consider it a waste. And the only thing about that makes me kind of cringe a little bit is, what if that wool did then go to create a coat for someone that would have otherwise bought a new coat, creating, you know, even some of the most ethically created products still have, like, a life cycle and a waste system, which ultimately affects the environment and ultimately affects more animals. So I know that's, like, a calculation that we have not prepared to actually answer, but that is something that I think about, that, like, in the long run, is it actually better for the animals due to the environmental ethics of recycling something that's already been created?
Well, I think with that, because then I think you're getting into this territory of, well, can I use this like discarded wool to make enough coats to prevent everyone from who wants a wool coat to get a wool coat? And I think the answer is certainly going to be no, unless you create this system and then you're like, oh wait, I've just created animal agriculture again.
What if it's like a couple wool coats?
But it's like, at some point you're going to have to stop doing that, right?
Yeah.
Or at some point it's like going to be like, okay, the entire human race has decided there's going to be 1,000 wool coats amongst them because that's how much extra wool we have, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, I feel like it's not this sustainable model. And it's the same thing when people talk about, like, the eggs being discarded or something like that, where it's like, yes, I guess the it's not, if the chickens are in a sanctuary, it's not necessarily harming them, but at the same time, not everyone is going to be able to get eggs that way. In fact, very few people are going to be able to get eggs that way. So it's not a sustainable thing. So it's not, because that's something that people do use as a kind of gotcha, like, wait a second, like, veganism actually doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Because, like, this isn't harming the chickens at all. But it's not going to be a sustainable model.
It's true. That's definitely true. I do want to sort of go back to something that you said, that essentially the idea of taking a little bit here and there and, like, maybe making 1,000 coats or whatever, eventually that does turn into a business model. And so we didn't read that first part of the email, but the person mentioned the sustainable brand that uses this leftover fabric. And I do wonder about a company that builds that into a business model. And are they then okay with saying, we're not going to make these anymore once that supply dries up? Or will they always want a supply of that? And even the well-intentioned aspect of that, does that lead to them creating a system where they can continue to get that wool? And even with sanctuaries that say, what if there's a sanctuary that was like, I'm going to sell our eggs, we're going to sell our wool, does that then even subconsciously affect which animals they choose to rescue because they know that they are more profitable than others? Like, I know sanctuary owners that have chosen to rescue and adopt animals that will need, like, some sort of, like, wheelchair or something, because they know that's much better for social media than, like, a full-grown cow that isn't, like, cute and adorable and has, like, is missing a leg. And like, that's sort of, like, this system that I don't want to buy into.
Yeah, I feel like those are different situations, because I feel like the using the wool or using the eggs. Like you said, it's just at some point you're no longer just like, oh, I'm using the excess stuff. At some point you just have created a business out of this thing.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's going against why someone would start a sanctuary. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess ultimately it comes back to the end motivations of the company. But I think about that in terms of nonprofit organizations. And that's like a critique that's levied at all sorts of nonprofits. But certainly within the vegan world, it's like we're working to make sure that we don't need these nonprofits anymore. And like I sell vegan clothing, all organic cotton. And I'm essentially working towards a world in which there's not a need for that because it's not a message people need to put out because it's the norm. And it's not like why would you promote, you know, this thing that almost everybody's doing? And so it's like I have to understand that for me personally, like sales can go down and I have to be like okay with that because ultimately, hopefully that means that like we're actually creating the world that we want. And that means that certain people, certain businesses, certain nonprofits won't have to exist. And so I guess I always just kind of question motivations of someone that's using those recycled materials because are they willing to let their business go when we create a more like just equitable world that is more responsible and is recycling or not even purchasing new items anymore?
I mean, I guess an animal sanctuary, which is in the same boat, right? Ideally, we wouldn't need animal sanctuaries, at least farm animal sanctuaries, because we just wouldn't have those animals that need to be rescued. But I guess the animal sanctuary could come back and say, well, for the time being, I'm going to, knowing that I'm eventually, hopefully, going to be obsolete, for the time being, I'm going to use these products while these animals are still around,
yeah.
Knowing that I'm eventually not going to have to use them. I guess they could make that argument.
Well, I mean, I think maybe you could look at it the same way that we look about like spaying and neutering animals, which is something that I think most people would agree is basically violating the bodily autonomy of dogs and cats. But it is something that we're like, we're doing this for now because this is a problem that we've created. And like, I think, you know, it's a part of like acknowledging that like, even if we're anti-speciesist, there's still things that we do that we engage in. I think the spaying and neutering is sort of the most common example. That, like, when you get down to it, you're like, I don't know if this is really, truly anti-speciesist, but I understand it's something I have to engage in for the time being, because we created this problem, and this is, in theory, this is the best way to handle it, or to address it, until we get to a point when we're not breeding animals anymore, and there's, like, a population that we're not, you know, making out of control because people want designer dogs.
I mean, I guess the sanctuary could say the same exact thing. Like, they could say, this is the thing that we need to do in order to stay in business, because certainly most of them are probably struggling for money. I'm sure that, I mean, besides like big donations that they're getting from donors, like I'm sure they don't have that much, you know, profit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's why I understand the perspective. Someone's like, this animal is cuter and is going to get more hits. So I'm going to, you know, because it's so hard to raise money on the sanctuary. Like, I don't like approve it, but I understand the mindset.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
All right.
So we have one more email we could respond to, but we'd love to talk to y'all. So if anybody in the audience has questions, I don't know, we got a microphone over there. We got a hand back there. So let's just, like, do that.
Hi. Something I've noticed is that the pharmaceutical industry is very unfriendly to vegans or just anyone who needs to avoid animal products for health or allergy reasons. I was curious about your thoughts on that, trying to avoid animal products while also needing or wanting to get prescription medications or whatnot.
Yeah, this is my opinion. This is certainly, I'm not going to speak for Andy, but I feel like if you need something to help you function through the day, then I don't think that's something that someone should feel guilty about doing. And I think that I'm sure the pharmaceutical industry is probably stoked that people are blaming themselves instead of blaming the actual industry, because it's their practices and they're the ones that ideally need to change. I know recently, who was it? So one of the US government departments.
EPA.
Yeah, the EPA recently said that they were going to stop. They were putting in practices to eliminate animal testing in their research. Which is cool, and hopefully that kind of like spreads to other things. But I think, you know, I think what if that's something that you feel passionate about, what you can do is kind of try and put pressure or support campaigns that put pressure on research practices and changing research practices. Because I don't necessarily think it's something that should. It's another one of these instances where it's like we've we've created this system and we've done this thing for so long that this is how the system is. And in general, there's a lot of things in our life that are very non-vegan that we can't really do much about because it's just how things have been doing. But I think we can start, and I don't think we should necessarily blame ourselves for some of those things, but we can start to put pressure on how those systems are proceeding, and hopefully there's change at the systemic level. Do you have any, is that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is specifically addressing what you're asking, but I feel like often the people that are most putting pressure on those that require medications to not use them because they're not vegan because they're testing on animals are usually the people that don't rely on those medications. And so it's like people are asking something that is people to do something that they themselves do not have to actually consider the implications of doing. So, yeah, I think that just, again, community care, all that stuff is like creating a culture where we're understanding of the fact that we live in a very non-vegan world and that there are certain concessions that we might have to make. But like all of those things are more at a systemic level, which doesn't mean we abdicate our personal responsibility, but there are certain things that we can spend time on that'll have a much bigger effect than worrying about those things. And like activists that give people a hard time for things like that, to me it feels like a super misguided use of our time, because there's so many people that like we can talk to that don't have to rely on certain medications or haven't even thought about having a vegan hot dog ever in their life. And like those are people we can talk to. And anyone that's out there like really giving people a hard time because they need their insulin or whatever it might be, to me that's like really unproductive. And I think as a culture, a vegan culture, if there is such a thing, that like we need to be pushing back against that. So
I definitely think it's like it sets barriers for people. It makes veganism less accessible for many people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people want a vegan club and not necessarily a vegan world because there is something like special about being vegan, sort of. And people want to set this really high bar. And I think it's important to welcome people in where they're at.
Hi there. So mine's a two-part question in this. With this sort of more surplus availability of alternatives with companies like Light Life, Beyond Meat, things like that, I wanted to get your idea of the thoughts of sort of the progress where we've come to overcome objections like, oh, I enjoy bacon too much, I enjoy cheese too much, I could never go vegan. And then the progress we still have yet to make to get to a more fully vegan ideal world.
So yeah, we've talked pretty extensively about things like the Impossible Whopper, like the Beyond Burger, and a lot of these things that I think are the kind of replacements that are, in my opinion, are doing good in terms of making people who think like, oh, wow, all vegan food is terrible, making them possibly change their mind about those things. So I think, you know, it's like, especially with the Impossible Whopper recently, it's like you can go on YouTube and there's a lot of people doing like a lot of non-vegans that are doing like A-B testing, and a lot of like you're seeing a lot of positive results. So I feel like that sort of thing, not necessarily just the Impossible Whopper, but there are definitely these products that are helping to change that culture of like, wow, all vegan food is not good. I know someone is here wearing a shirt that says, just because it's vegan doesn't mean it sucks. So it's like I definitely think that there is this change in culture where people aren't like, oh, vegan food, you mean salads and kale and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Which I think is good for the accessibility of it.
Yeah, I mean, so Paul has been vegan 10 years, I've been vegan 12 years. So we, even in that time period...
Brag.
In that time period, I've seen a massive shift in the availability of products, and not necessarily accessible to every single person due to like budget reasons, things like that. But I think about 5, 6, whatever years ago when I was touring college campuses and doing outreach to people, showing them videos of what happens to animals in the agriculture system. And then afterwards, the main part was having a big conversation about like that, like just saying, how do you feel about this? Like, what are your obstacles? And then working with them. And they're like, I only eat fast food. And you're like, okay, well, you can go to Taco Bell. And like, I think about how much easier it would be to have that conversation with someone right now, knowing how many other places, like you're like, okay, go to Burger King, go to Carl's Jr., go, you know, whatever it is, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. And so I think for all of the reservations I have about, you know, capitalism being horrible and this monster that's crushing us all, I can't be mad at the increase of accessibility to certain people of certain incomes to get these things. And, you know, knowing so many college students that I talked to that only ate at fast food ever, and like knowing it's there now. So I think that to try and kind of answer your first half of that question, is that I don't think a lot of those excuses are, I think they're starting to like go away. And when I talk to people now about veganism, it's like, I guess it's a different crop of excuses that come up, but the idea that like, oh, all vegan food sucks now, like I feel like so many people that are not fully vegan or even partially or like even considering, they understand that like the food is good and they're not going to miss out on anything right now. So like I generally view those things as positive, even though I have mixed feelings about everything in life. So.
And then in terms of the second question, Andy, do you think we just need to keep pumping these out? Do we need the next, we have the Impossible, the Beyond Burger, do we need the next adjective burger?
I'm so sick of burgers, Paul. Every week there's a new company with a new bleeding burger. I think that's a piece of the puzzle. I don't think that consumerism saves us. I don't think that gets us there. But I think it's a lot easier to, you know, to get there, to have conversations with people. Because people want to know that, like, the cupcakes are good, you know? But if you just make cupcakes, that's not going to create a vegan world. We need people that are having the tough conversations and there to answer the objections when, like, a news story comes up in, you know, media. I'm trying to think of something, like, I don't know, there's big protests in Australia that was, like, shutting down traffic and all that stuff. And it's like, we need vegans here to answer the question, like, well, why did someone care so much that they were willing to go and shut down traffic? And so it's the increase of these vegan options, it's a piece of the puzzle. And I think the day that there's a perfect replica of vegan steak and eggs, because I don't think Just Egg is there yet. You know, like once that's there, it becomes easier and everyone has the height of the hurdle that they're willing to go over to become vegan. And as we move through time, those hurdles are lowering and lowering and lowering because the objection, even in the 12 years I've been vegan, almond milk was this weird fringe thing. And now everybody I know drinks almond milk. Like doing outreach on campuses, people are like, oh yeah, I drink almond milk already. And I was like, oh, okay. Like people just prefer it. People think it's weird to drink cow's milk and dairy is on a decade after decade after decade decline. So I guess I'm just repeating myself, but essentially it's all a piece of the puzzle. I'm glad that there are companies that work on that stuff. But if we just tend to sit back and think that's going to do all the work for us, I think we fall into a trap that is not going to create not even just a vegan world, but a just and equitable world, which is, I think, even bigger than just saying a vegan world.
Yeah, and I think something that these products are doing is they are, because like a lot of news, big news outlets are picking up stories about these products. So I think there are people who would not be having conversations or would not be seeing the word vegan flash in front of them are seeing that now. So like Andy was saying, I think now more than ever, it's important to be there to have those conversations with people. Because it's certainly possible that someone's going to make the change on their own, but I think it's going to be much more likely for someone to make a big lifestyle change if there's someone there to support them to do it and to have those conversations and to answer the questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool, thank you.
All right, we got a hand over there.
Hello. How do you use humor with friends and family and remain accessible and chill while you're out eating with them and hanging out and not sacrifice your beliefs or back down or become very sad about that?
Great question.
I think that's a great question. I think that there's definitely, I mean, clearly this is going to be individualized to every single person because you're going to have your own kind of your brand of humor. You're going to know how much you can joke with your friends and family. But I do think this isn't exactly getting at your question, but I do think it's so important to be able to set some boundary with your friends and family, because I think what a lot of vegans have experienced, if they're the only vegan or vegetarian in their friend group or in their family, like what a lot of people do experience is that just like the constant making fun of people. And I think one possible reaction is to just kind of be like, haha, yeah, it's funny. I'm vegan. I eat grass. But I think it is important that like you're able to set some boundary with them. And obviously this is would be an incredibly difficult and uncomfortable conversation to have, or at least for me it would. But being able to set this boundary and be like, no, this is something that is very important to me. This is something that I truly believe in. And I know you are not there, but like I would ask you to respect what I believe in, or something like that. I feel like this isn't you were asking kind of the opposite question, right? About how to use humor to maybe have those conversations. But that's just what that reminded me of, so I went off on that tangent. And did you want to answer the actual question?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's so hard to individualize things. Because we get these emails all the time that are like, how do I talk to my parents about this? How do I talk to my partner about this? And everyone has such different dynamics. So this is kind of just saying what you were saying, but when I was doing like outreach on campuses, some people you talk to, like I always just matching their tone, and maybe they're kind of jokey, or maybe they're like swearing and you swear back and they're like, oh, I didn't realize this like official person could swear. And then that kind of like breaks down the barrier. So I think that if you have like your snarky remarks to things, some people really respond to that. And then like you get them and it kind of feels good, but it's humorous enough that they don't feel like you're just like kind of beating them down with the information. So, I mean, I guess I would say don't feel afraid to use the humor, but it's like, you know how your friends are going to react to the things that you say. You know how far you can push things. But absolutely, to echo what Paul said, is setting that boundary is super important. And I've definitely had moments in my life where I've done the jokey thing and had the humor thing, and they just kind of didn't get it. And eventually I was like, you know, it like really upsets me when you say these things. Could you stop doing that? And 9 times out of 10, people are receptive of that. Some people just find joy in provoking others, but I think a lot of people, they don't understand, and I think this is a failure of the vegan movement as a whole, to really understand the seriousness of the issue at hand. And a lot of people do think of it, they're like, oh yeah, you're on some diet right now, and whatever, tofu. You know, they don't really understand like what's actually at stake. So sometimes explaining those things when you are setting that boundary is a way to sort of convey it. And, you know, sometimes a lot of people don't expect someone, I don't know how you're like, I'm not someone that's like super assertive all the time. And so then when I get to that point where I'm like, hey, actually, can we stop? Like, that really sucks. And I don't like hanging out with you when you do that. And people go, oh, okay. Like, I'm not this guy that's always joking around, turned on the serious face. And that is what got them to stop joking around. So, yeah, again, it's just so individual. But I'd say don't be afraid to use humor. Like, I find like comics like Vegan Sidekick, you know, he gets at the truth of the kernel of like the reasoning of so many people, but in a humorous way. But again, it just depends on who you're talking to. So hopefully that helps.
I kind of have a two-parter as well. It's vegans versus vegetarians battle. So I understand a lot of people are in different. I've been trying to get this in my head the whole time while listening to you guys, so it just be a second. Different points of their journey. So I've been vegetarian now for a year. But if you're a vegan talking to a vegetarian who potentially knows everything about the animal rights issues, which they most likely do, when does your activism go too far? And what would you recommend to people who are on that journey, who are trying to cut out stuff, who get confronted with, I don't want to use a word, but kind of more like a militant vegan, because I've heard vegetarians being called liquid meat eaters and all kinds of stuff. So how would you recommend that they continue on their journey without getting pushed away by those types of vegans?
Well, I think, so the kind of philosophy that I like to have is that everyone's kind of on this spectrum of, I guess, empathy or compassion or whatever you want to call it. And it's like, I think that the point of being a vegan advocate or advocating for animals is to get people, just like nudge people down that spectrum. And I think that that's going to look different for different people. And ideally, it's like, yeah, as a vegan advocate, ideally we want people to be vegan. But I also think that there is this attitude of certain people in the vegan community of like, okay, I've become vegan, so now I've reached the end of that journey, when in fact I think we should always be striving to better ourselves in various different ways in our life. So I think, I don't know, I guess this is what I would say to those people, but it's like, I feel like it's probably unproductive to bully people if the ultimate goal is to try to, you know, further them down that spectrum. But I think the thing that maybe is going to, and of course I'm not going to be able to get like all those random people to stop doing that. But I guess as the person on the receiving end, And I guess this also applies to vegans who experience harassment from other people, like non-vegans as well. But just, you know, I mean, and it sucks too, but just thinking about like why you're doing this and realizing like, okay, I'm doing this for something other than myself. If you're doing it for like the ethical reasons, I'm doing this for something other than me. And yeah, these people shouldn't be doing this thing to me, but this is bigger than me. Does that make sense, Andy? What do you think?
Sort of. Yeah, I mean, I guess what you're getting at is something that we have talked about, which is this idea, and it applies to veganism, but also like other ethical and moral issues, which is we're almost always more upset at the people that are like so close to us, but they're just like 3 inches away, as opposed to the person that's like 2 miles away. And like, and we're just like, why don't you get it? You just want to like shake people. And I think that like we need to get out of that. I think there's so much gatekeeping that happens in veganism, and even amongst, you know, vegans in terms of things like, well, the bone char sugar or palm oil or like other things like that, which are not things that we should just disregard. But I think that like as humans, we have this tendency to be like, I'm the gatekeeper, and I'm going to be the one that lets you into the club. So this is almost like not responding to your question, but it's sort of just like our general thoughts on like for vegans that are in the audience is that like vegetarians are like, it's like a gift. It is someone that's like on that spectrum and they're working towards it, and people that should be encouraged. Like personally, I find that I've gotten the most fruitful, I don't know what word I'm looking for, response out of people when I'm encouraging of them, as opposed to being like, you're not doing enough.
And I mean, it's like, there are people who go from being meat eaters to being vegan. Certainly there are people that do that. But I would say, I mean, I myself and Andy too, and many people that I've talked to, it's like we were vegetarian for a number of years before we went vegan. And I do think that some vegans forget that they also were that at some point too. And they want to say like, well, I made this change. It's like, well, I'm here now. So why aren't you here with me now? Again, not really understanding that like everyone is on their own journey, and we want to encourage people along that journey. But I guess it's hard to, I don't know, what about like addressing, like what could we say, like if you were in that position, like what would you say to those sorts of people who are saying those things?
I don't know. I mean, I can only speak for like how, so if you came up to me at the merch table and you're like, I'm a vegetarian, I'd be like, I'm glad you're here. I hope you try some good food and have a good time. You know, like that's like where I'm at with that. And I think that if they're, I don't know, because like I get it. It's like we all feel like we have like the answer and the key, and if we can just push people and push that button and like twist their arm a little bit, then maybe they'll realize like the harm that's being done. But I think keeping in mind that like actually like saying something like that, like you were once where I was, and like I hope you can understand how I felt. And like there's that whole thing about like be the vegan that you would want to meet before you went vegan. I think that's a part of it. Like just be like, listen, I was once where you were. You once were probably not vegan. And you would hate me as a vegetarian giving you a hard time for eating animals right then. So, like, let's extend that compassion.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of sucks because someone that's like that is probably just going to be, might not respond well to that sort of thing. But it's like, some people are just jerks. And that stinks. So don't be a jerk.
Hi there. I have not been here this whole time, so I'm sorry if this is a repeat. But something that's important for me is, you know, I guess like the ethical end of eating, and something I struggle a lot with is the trade-offs. So like you mentioned with palm oil, like there's things in the world that are also very impactful in negative ways. And I'm just wondering if you have resources for navigating that or anything. Because for me, being vegan, of course, it's the cruelty aspect, but I'm in the environmental field. So the lowering my environmental impact is also huge. But things that I have a hard time with are, you know, products that are vegan that are made of plastic that end up in the oceans and impact, you know, marginalized countries and communities. And I'm just wondering if there's any resources out there to help navigate and make those sorts of decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such an immensely complicated thing, and we wrestle with this all the time, because I think especially when you first get into being vegan and you have this mindset of I learn thing is bad and I stop buying it. And you're like, cool, that's the easy way to navigate this. And then you're like, and then I learn there's issue with palm oil. Okay, I won't buy that. And then I learn there's issue with this. I won't buy that. And then you start to like you start to, like, pull your hair out because you're like, I can't possibly not buy everything. But I think that, so it feels overwhelming. The biggest resource that I like to point people towards is the Food Empowerment Project, which is a vegan food justice organization. It takes a very, I guess, holistic view and talks about, you know, workers' rights and chocolate sourcing and bananas and coffee and, like, all that stuff. And you go to the website and there's just, like, all this list of everything. And we've had Lauren, their founder, on the show twice now. And we've asked her, like, how do we, like, deal with this? And she's like, just make it manageable. Just, like, start with one thing and, like, go from there. And like, understand that you can't do everything. And it's just about sort of, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but, like, doing the best you can. But I find that, like, going through it's foodispower.org and just, like, looking at the issues and going, I can do something about this. Like, this is an issue that I can easily address. I can easily download an app on my phone that lets me know the source of this brand of chocolate when I go to purchase it at the store. Things like that. But yeah, I mean, I don't have any big answers because it is the type of thing that when you like individualize the thing, like I as one human being have the weight of the world on my shoulders to do this. And it's like, it's important for us to, you know, purchase things that we feel like align with our ethics, but ultimately it's equal or maybe more important to work on changing the system that allows products to be made with plastic or whatever it is. So I guess that's like kind of how I think about it, is that we need both. We need the micro, we need the macro, and finding organizations or you start a campaign, whatever it is, to get XYZ company to stop using plastic. You know, that's like one example. There's so many things to be done. But I think that giving ourselves a little bit of leeway to mess up and like not be perfect with every purchase that we make, knowing that we live in an inherently unethical system. That's just like how I manage it. Like I try to do the best I can. I try to educate myself as much as possible. And we try to speak to people that can talk to that point of view. But there's only so much that we can do, and it's just taking it one step at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to echo what Andy said. And I think like trying to tackle things at the systemic level in addition to the individual level, because I know we in an episode recently, I learned that for instance, the recycling movement was created by like the Coca-Cola industry and other big industries as a way to shift the blame off of them, because people were trying to be like, wait a second, Coca-Cola, aren't you like creating a lot of waste? And Coke was like, no, it's on you. You have to recycle these things, even though they're the ones that's producing it. So it's like there are these huge issues. And as an individual person, I can totally understand why it seems so overwhelming. It's like, well, what am I going to do about this issue? So I think, you know, and again, I wish that I had like a specific organization or nonprofit or something that was working towards that. But organizations, working with organizations that are trying to tackle the systemic level, but then also at the individual level, just like, you know, how at one point I realized that, oh, it's not matching my ethics to continue using animal products, so I'm going to stop using animal products. And that was difficult at first, but then over time, it just kind of became my lifestyle and it became easier because it was just the thing that I did. I think maybe there's like a lot of issues in the environment, but taking a manageable amount of them and being able to make those changes. So maybe, for instance, like I know for me, I'm trying to work on the chocolate one. And like Andy said, Food Empowerment Project, they have a list of basically different vegan brands that use chocolate and whether or not it's sourced from an ethically, whether or not it's ethically sourced. And it's difficult to at first because it's like, oh, I'm so used to just pick it. It's like, oh, this chocolate is vegan. Cool, I'm going to have it. And now it's this kind of additional step. But my hope is that over time, that also just becomes like a natural thing and just a part of my life. And it's just a thing that I don't really need to think about anymore. But yeah, while you're doing it, it seems like a difficult thing to keep up with. So I can totally empathize with that.
Cool. I think we have time for one more big hand down there.
Hi. This is not in retaliation to a previous question. I've wanted to ask this for a while. And you kind of touched on it with the previous question. Do you promote the abolitionist approach or the individual journey, which in my opinion detracts away from the actual issue of the animals? Because I feel you can approach the abolitional approach to anybody, because you don't have to be a jerk about it, right? And ultimately, it's the individual's decision if they want to listen to you or not. They'll go at their own pace. But I feel if my opinion is to use the abolition approach every time to keep the issue on the animals. I just want to know what your approach is.
Yeah, well, I think that I don't think that those two things are in opposition to each other, personally. And, like, you know, I'm certainly well familiar with, like, Francione's work that, like, really kind of lays those things out. I think there's a way to, like, so, for instance, when I had a job where I was actually traveling around talking to people about going vegan, I would never say I would always, if someone's like, oh, yeah, I can start by eating vegan one day a week, I don't say, oh, that's great. I say, that's a really good first step to take. And it's, like, the way that I sort of frame that thing as it is, like, something that you can work towards. And so, I don't know, I don't think that there's anything wrong with acknowledging the fact that there is, like, a spectrum of things. We don't ever talk about things, or we try not to talk about things in a way that's, like, animal use is okay, ever. But there's, like, acknowledging those things. Like, I find that a lot of the theory behind a lot of the abolitionist thinking, specifically from, like, that school, it, like, you listen to it, you're like, that makes sense. And then you go out into the actual world and you talk to people and you're like, okay, maybe that's not exactly how it works when you're communicating with people. So I think that you can acknowledge that all animal use is inherently unethical while still understanding, you know, like what you're saying, like, people are going to do with it what they will. So the message that we put out is all animal use is unethical. We want no cages, not bigger cages. But if you want to just, like, start to explore these things, like, I'm encouraging of that. Like, I'm never going to shoot someone down and be like, oh, you only want to eat vegan a couple of days a week? Like, that's not good enough. It's like, that's great. I'm so glad that you're doing that, because I find that to be much more helpful to people, getting them to that point when they finally get to that point where, like, oh, yeah, animal use is unethical, and I'm not going to engage in it anymore. Does that respond to your question? A little bit?
Yeah, I think I definitely want to echo Andy that, like, we spend a lot of time thinking about, like, our language use and how that's really portraying the things that we're trying to portray. And so we are, you know, very particular when we say things, like, even Andy said, what did you just say? Like, when someone says, oh, I'm going to stop eating meat once a week, you're like, instead of saying that's great, you would say, like, that's a great start or something like that. It's like little things like that, that to me, at least, it's still getting across what my ultimate ethic is, and that I'm not necessarily condoning the use of animals. So I don't know. That's something that's been a journey for me over the last 4 years of making this podcast, of, like, my evolving language and how I can really, like, perfectly verbalize how I'm feeling about these things, because it's difficult. It's like, and especially when you're having a conversation and you don't have time to pre-think about what you're going to say, but, like, the more you do it, the more you can kind of really nail down and get across what you, like, how you feel without it being, like, attacking someone else or anything like that.
Yeah.
All right.
I think that about is our time, right?
Yeah. I think so.
That's it.
Just a big shout out to the Halifax Veg Fest, all the organizers, Darren, who helped us out with sound, the interpreter, just everyone that's been helping putting this together. It's really, really great. This has been a really cool event.
It's been such a fantastic journey for us to be here. All right. Well, Paul, we talked a lot about self-care today. And, you know, people get burned out on things, but I know I'll never get burned out on hearing this amazing crowd saying the following 7 words.
Awesome. Thank you so much,
y'all.
Everyone. Okay. We're good.
We have a signal. All right.
We do. Sorry, everybody.
Not the first time this has happened. We're pretty used to sitting awkwardly in front of people.
Ready?
Let's do this thing.